two very sobering figures to start this show. $6.2 billion and $10,000. $6.2 billion is the total amount spent on healthcare here in Vermont alone. And $10,000 is the average per person. That's per person per every man, woman, and child expenditure each year on healthcare, again, just here in Vermont. We are paying too much for healthcare, and our outcomes are not good enough. Let's get into it. Today's show deals with healthcare, a topic of perennial concern, debate, and disagreement. Ironic, really, given that the past year has illustrated so clearly how vulnerable we all are to a health crisis and how fundamental our healthcare systems and our workers are to our very existences. And yet we still disagree on a basic premise: whether or not healthcare is a public good, whether or not quality healthcare is a right for all or a privilege for a few. Beyond that premise lays the beating heart of this issue: how to organize and how to pay for and how to manage an equitable system of quality healthcare that actually does what fundamentally is the only thing we want from our healthcare system: to feel better. We'll get into this today with a true expert on the subject, Dr. Deb Richter.
Thanks for that great opening, David, and welcome to all of the listeners for this episode and this topic that I know is going to resonate with everybody. The need for healthcare touches every person, even those who are able to get care. They always have stories about the struggles with the process, with forms, with pre-authorization and wait lists. And I can tell you there are plenty of stories from Vermonters who have no care, who have care with such high deductibles they can't use it. So I am ready to dive in with Dr. Deb Richter and to explore healthcare from the perspective of the patient and the provider, and to learn what might be possible to achieve right here in Vermont. There is no one in our beautiful state of Vermont that is more familiar with the landscape and possibilities around healthcare than our guest, Dr. Deb Richter. Dr. Deb is a practicing family physician, and she provides services and support to those in recovery from alcohol and substance abuse. She is also a long time, maybe our longest time, advocate for single-payer healthcare, and she was instrumental in Vermont passing a single-payer healthcare bill in 2011. And that bill included a timeline and a framework for how we would get there, but it has yet to be achieved. Dr. Deb continues to cross the state, meeting with Rotary clubs, businesses, doctors, and activists, and sharing her knowledge, experience, perspective, and passion for affordable and accessible healthcare for all. We are so grateful to have Dr. Deb Richter joining us on our Bold Ideas podcast today.
Dr. Deb, thank you. Thank you again for being with us here today. This is a very important conversation, one we've actually been looking forward to for quite a while, and I know we've all thought about this consistently and comprehensively. No one more so than you. So we're grateful for your time, and certainly having an expert on these issues related to healthcare and access and affordability. It's so critical, and always has been critical, but so much more critical now after all we've been through. And that really, Dr. Deb, is how I'd like to begin. And it's in many ways the same questions that I've asked all of our guests to begin. What has this past year showed you? What has this past year, if you will, taught you? The lessons of the pandemic year, and obviously it's not over yet, but what are the most important lessons that you've derived over this period of time that we can then help to extrapolate on and utilize to move us forward?
Well, I would say, first of all, in terms of just how the pandemic happened and spread and whatever in this country and around the world, is we've spent far too little on public health. And the issue of poverty, I would say we've learned, a lot of negative things about our society, in this country and also around the world. And again, this emphasis on conspiracies and all these things that have kind of affected everybody's health. But we all are dependent on each other. We all affect each other. I mean, this started with wherever it started with one person. And it has killed 4 million people worldwide, more than 600,000 in this country. Fortunately, in Vermont, I think on the positive side, we've managed to grab hold of it and do the best of what you could do under these circumstances, which is to implement single payer for the administration of vaccines. This was all publicly funded money that developed the vaccine, that distributed the vaccine and administered the vaccine. All of that was done with public money. So we do know that if we put our hearts and minds in the right place, that we actually can deliver healthcare to everyone and have it be publicly funded. So we've done a lot of really good things, I think, in Vermont. I think this is really, we should pat ourselves on the back. You know, I think more than 82% of the Vermont population now is immunized. And that gives us somewhat of herd immunity. So we really are in a really good place. If you look around the country, not so much. So we've seen the best and the worst just across this country.
And Dr. Deb, just to really highlight what you said about us being the most vaccinated state in the country, and certainly since people around the nation listen to this podcast, it was humbling. In many ways, it was exciting, but humbling yesterday. Before I even had a chance to look at the news, I started getting people sending me notes that the front headline on CNN was that Vermont was the most healthy, the most vaccinated place in the nation. And to your point, that's an extraordinary level of achievement. But I think your point that is really critical that we'll get into is that was a clear utilization of an infrastructure, of a governmental infrastructure to provide vaccines to your extent. It was public option for vaccine. And I think that we have to make sure that point is not lost, but in fact is really overarching in this conversation, because that worked, certainly here in Vermont, to some lesser extent around the nation, but it clearly works.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not even a public option. This is basically implementation of public coverage for something that everyone is entitled to. Now, people have chosen not to get it, but everyone was entitled. That's essentially what single payer is. It can still be private delivery. We're doing vaccines in my privately owned primary care clinic, but we are getting publicly funded vaccines that are publicly paid for. And that's all single payer is. The difference is from what the public option is, that's sort of, well, maybe if you decide to get that coverage. This is basically everyone is entitled to this particular form of coverage. And that was for the vaccine. Our philosophy in Vermont Healthcare for All and many people around the state is that, and around the country, is that we need to extend this to all aspects of care and start with universal primary care, for example. Publicly fund primary care for all Vermonters. Let's start with that. So this is just one example of how we can get that done.
I think one of the things that folks around the country listening to this, they really need to hear is don't write Vermont off as you're a little state or whatever. Like, we are a state with urban areas, with diverse populations, with rural areas, and we used some very creative approaches to get to where people were at to get them healthcare. And I think, you know, one of the things I often hear you talking about, Dr. Deb, is access and affordability. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned in terms of how the vaccine was distributed, in terms of making it so people could get the access that they needed, removing the financial barrier, as you said, using a state-run single-payer model for this piece of it, and then looking at what we can learn from the infrastructure about what really is required in order for a system where everybody's in.
And that's a really good point. When you think about what I see every single day in primary care is people are increasingly having to pay out of pocket for things that are preventive. For example, if you have diabetes, you should be getting regular visits with your primary care clinician. You should be doing regular blood tests to make sure that you've got good control. Well, if you have an out-of-pocket cost of a $5,000 deductible, many people do not do that. So what we end up with is more expensive care. So that's the thing the vaccine showed us, is that we got people in the door because they knew they weren't going to have to pay out of pocket for it. And there are many other examples of that, where we want people to receive certain care. We don't want them to ignore their primary care. We don't want them to ignore their chronic diseases where they can prevent further complications.
Dr. Deb, your comments lead me to, I think, what is really a profound complexity around this, because so much of what you're talking about, not related to vaccines, but related to care generally, relates to access and to choice. And to the extent, as you said at the outset, the wealthy have, if you will, always had a choice relative to healthcare, where they go, so many different things, but the vast majority of the population does not have that same level of choice and access. And as again you said, poverty is such an extraordinarily corollary to bad health outcomes because of that lack of access and choice. So to the extent that we look at, and this is really what I'd love for you to talk about, health as a public good. So we have discussed over and over again as a society about those things that are public good, those things that are in the common space, whether it's education or police or fire. Healthcare, in my opinion, is certainly a public good. And so we need to be able to address that within the context of an infrastructure. And I was thinking this morning as I was thinking about this conversation, for example, obviously, fire, police, education, as we discussed, are public goods. And I think one thing people need to be able to think about is generally when a person's house is on fire, he or she doesn't have to join a waiting list or sit in a waiting room in order to get their house fire extinguished. And right. So there's an intellectual gymnastics relative to a public good for which maybe because it is so opaque and hard to understand is a different context than just simply dialing 911 and having the local fire department come and extinguish the flames.
And you make excellent points, because healthcare should be a public good. It's not treated as such. What we do is, the way we fund healthcare is basically we fund it with sick people's insurance or lack thereof. So the entities, the providers of care, the doctors and the hospitals and the nurses, et cetera, we have no dedicated financing for that. So what ends up happening is that we erect this administrative bureaucracy to pay for it. So you have providers that are trying to get paid, and you have and payers that are basically trying to avoid paying it. And all of that creates this tremendous bureaucracy, because we don't have guaranteed coverage with guaranteed payment for the providers of care. In other words, a public good, like we do education, right? We have, we know that we have certain budgets we put in place and we pay them through taxes. And that's why we need to treat healthcare as a public good. You're absolutely right. It's right now treated as a private commodity, only for those who happen to have very good insurance. And it's often, by the way, the working poor that actually have the worst insurance. The very, very poor oftentimes have Medicaid, so they at least have some coverage. But the working poor often are the ones that are uninsured. They're the ones with the worst insurance policies. And so they're the ones that avoid the care. And so we end up with not having adequate financing and funding for the services that we all want.
And to your point, preventative care clearly lowers costs for everyone. And let's just take that same analog that we were discussing before. That's why there are so many regulations around proper insulation, proper wiring, proper setbacks from foliage or from dry brush to prevent that fire that the fire department will have to come and put out. We don't do the same thing. In fact, we, as you said, so many people wait until there is a crisis in order to receive care because of the cost, because of the issues of access, because of the issues of equity in care. And so again, to the extent that if we were really to look at healthcare as that public good, as that absolute human basic right, that's it. We would finance it in the same way that we finance the other public goods.
Absolutely. We would fund, heavily fund, and invest way more in primary care, mental health, and substance use disorder services. Because those are the things that if you fund them, people will have access to them. If you make sure that people have coverage for those things are the things that actually help prevent more expensive diseases and more complications. But what we do is the things that people are, because we're an insurance-based system, the things that people are more likely to use and need are the things that aren't funded, the primary care and mental health services. So those are the things that we are, our system is upside down, whereas you're right, in other countries that, by the way, pay for everyone's care, it's on roughly half the cost, they have better outcomes, better quality than we do, and they spend less because they invest way more in those frontline services, the mental health and primary care services. So they have roughly, in most countries, 50% of their clinicians are primary care and 50% specialists. Sometimes it's even 2/3 primary care, 1/3 specialists. In this country, it's the opposite. So we have way more specialists than we do primary care, and that's much more expensive way to deliver care to our population.
Dr. Deb, so, you know, I'm fully on board, as you know, and I agree with, you know, David calling this a public option, you calling it a public option. I'm wondering if you could help paint the picture a little bit about how, if we shifted our thinking around healthcare, it would start to address the astronomical increases in cost of healthcare every year. Because I think, you know, as a consumer, as a Vermont taxpayer, I think one of the messages that gets really obscured when we talk about this is that we're already paying for our healthcare. And what we're paying for, we're getting nothing for. And because it's complicated, everybody tunes it out. People say, I don't pay anything when it comes out of their paycheck. How can we reframe this conversation in a way that makes it clear, as David said, to what you think about when you think about your fire department, or even if you think about sending your kids to school? How can we help to show that we, the public, are all on the same team here? And how can we leverage our team to start to put some barriers or some roadblocks or stop signs in the rising costs? Because we saw from the latest, you know, report from the auditor, right, the way that healthcare costs are rising is higher than anything, higher than housing, higher than utilities. We have to find ways to address that. So from your perspective as both a provider and an advocate on this, like, where do you see those touch points of trying to make this conversation go to providing access for everyone and lowering the overall costs?
Well, first of all, we have to remember, we do have a law in place, Act 48, that was passed in 2011, that implemented a system of wanting to cover everyone, but we had to come up with a financing mechanism. You know, we learned from that the, you know, legislature was not ready to do it all at once. And that's quite understandable, given that you'd have to replace private spending with public spending. And that's a tall order. But if you do it in a gradual way and phase it in over time, it's actually something that would be quite feasible. And we advocate starting with primary care because it is, you get the most bang for the buck. It's about 8% of total spending, including mental health and substance use disorder spending. So primary care, mental health, and substance use disorder services would be about 8%. And if you have to replace the private spending with public spending for that, it would be about $200 million a year, a 1.5% payroll tax. I'm not advocating that, but that's one way. So you phase it in over time. And if you do that over time, you show this works. People then get used to having, I think the next phase would actually, the better phase would be to put hospitals next, because then you put them on a budget. And we can talk about hospitals in a minute. But so you gradually phase it in over time, and you show that it does work. We've shown that with the vaccines. We've seen the vaccines, public funding of the vaccines, giving everyone access, not having them have out-of-pocket spending for essential services is something that you want to do. So you show them over gradual time. In terms of rising costs, our problem is, we have many problems in terms of why we're spending. We're spending 34 cents of every healthcare dollar on administrative costs in this country and in Vermont. Now, if you just take that amount and divide it by every Vermonter is $3,500 per person for every man, woman, and child in Vermont is spent on administrative costs. So that's the money for collecting and paying for healthcare and the total all administration. You need some administration, but that's twice what Canadians spend on administration. So on a nationwide basis, we could save $600 billion if we had a Medicare for all type of system for this country. We could save $600 billion in administrative costs. And if you spent the same amount of money as we're currently spending, we don't need to spend more than we're spending. That's what people need to remember. It's not on top of what we're spending, it's instead of. And what you're doing is you're taking the money from different pockets more fairly. You're taking the money basically based on people's ability to pay when you pay for it through taxes. That's what taxes are. And that's how we've determined we pay for our fire protection that way. We pay for our roads that way. We pay for our public education that way. All the things that David was saying are public good is the way we pay for things like that. We should pay for our hospitals and our health care that way. And we would get much better care out of it. We'd have a healthier society. We'd have more money, by the way, if we slow the rate of spending to spend on other things, better education, college for everyone. We'd have all these additional money. Right now, there's only so much money in the economic pie. If you spend 20% of that on healthcare, you have less money to spend on other things. Other countries.
So Dr. Deb, that allows us to have, again, the conversation that to this point has been perennial. But I do believe that Vermont can lead because we have been leading. Look at our outcomes relative to the vaccine and relative to the pandemic. Look at the infrastructure bill that is now looks like it will become reality. Again, so little conversation about healthcare within infrastructure, but my goodness, if there's anything that is infrastructure, it's our health, our body, our minds, our the society's healthcare. So there is a divide. And I don't want to necessarily call it a partisan divide or an ideological divide. There is a divide related to this subject. Again, related to whether or not it's a public good. Although I'm not sure if you went out and did a poll of X number of people around the country and just asked that question, I think most people would say, yeah, well, healthcare should be a public good. But beside that, there is a divide. So little progress has been made, A-Y, first question. B, how can Vermont, the experience we've had, inform some progress in the rest of the nation?
So your first question was, why have we had so little conversation about it? Well, I think at a national level, the reason is that Congress has been bought and sold by companies that stand to lose a lot if we have a Medicare for all-like system. So you have insurance companies, you have drug companies that will suddenly will have to compete based on price instead of what they're doing now, which is colluding and driving the price of drugs up. You'll have for-profit hospitals, for-profit dialysis units, et cetera. All of those companies stand to lose under a Medicare for all type system.
Just to that point, because it's an important one, the relative to the pharmaceutical company, how do you respond when people say, look, the R&D, what happens here in the U.S. affects the rest of the world, and without those incentives, that R&D doesn't happen. What's the response to that?
Well, the response is basically most drugs are developed with public money. So this is all essentially something that starts almost all the drugs. And let's face it, let's look at the COVID vaccine. Where did that money come from? The money to develop the COVID vaccine came from the government. And it the National Institute of Health gets a lot of money to develop drugs. And what happens then is they don't deliver the drugs. They basically don't manufacture the drugs from that point. They give it over to a drug company and the drug company makes a profit. So most drugs have been developed. The other thing to remember is it's a very small percentage of drug company spending. I think it's roughly 15% is on research and development. It's very tiny. Most of it is basically in the form of profit and promotion and advertising, those sorts of things. So
we've talked about that before. Your explanation is exactly what we talked about last time, DARPA, the program that really paved the way for the creation of this extraordinary internet world in which we live now. That was public money. That was American taxpayer money that created what now obviously is so dominant. So that's, I think, a very important answer to that question.
It's also, there are many drugs that are developed in other countries as well. And these are countries with public systems. And
so then my second question is, how do we move beyond this divide? Because it obviously has existed for, it's perennial.
How do we move beyond this divide? I think it's probably going to get easier at some point soon. There will be a tipping point. I'm seeing in my practice fairly well-off people who are now suffering under the deductibles and cost sharing. And we're starting to see it even among people who traditionally had very, very, very good insurance. So lots of groups, labor groups, et cetera, who have had fairly good insurance, who are now experiencing co-pays and deductibles, which they're not used to. That actually increases the public discord over this. And I think once you have enough, a critical mass of people to get the conversation going, it really is going to take, unfortunately, more people being upset about this subject. I mean, the other thing to remember is, in general, part of the reason this is difficult is 80% of the population at any one time is fairly healthy. 20% use 80% of the care. And that's an important thing when you're trying to mobilize. For example, young people rarely see the doctor. In fact, I believe it's 50% of the population uses only 5% of the healthcare dollar. 80% use 20% and vice versa, 20% use 80%. So that's the problem here, is that trying to get more public involvement in this issue is going to take a little bit more time. But I do think COVID has made things move along faster. And we just haven't seen, the dust hasn't settled yet from that, because people are still reeling in many states and terrified to go out anywhere. This is going to take a lot of public demand and massive rallies and massive public mobilization to get it over the hill, because Congress at this point has absolutely no incentive. They have all the incentive to keep the brakes on any kind of meaningful reform.
One of the things I love about this podcast is we just kind of go with the flow, and it allows space for really important things to be said, Dr. Deb. And one of the things that really struck me when you were speaking a minute ago about pharmaceuticals and the development of drugs is, you know, they have so much money to spend on PR and messaging. And then we have a conversation like this, and you say to us, it's already being paid for by our dollars. It's only 15% of their budget, yet you see the messaging that they put everywhere on the public. And it's like, if you do this, you will have nothing. And so I do think that that's a challenge that we will have to overcome. But I wanted to just change the conversation for one second before we get closer to winding it up, and kind of take it to the perspective of a doctor, because I've heard from you, I've heard from other doctors. I know in Vermont we're facing an acute shortage of primary care doctors. And I was wondering about if you could just frame this conversation a little bit about what it means to people in this field, what it means to a practicing physician to use the system we have now, versus if we were able to implement a public option system, a single payer system, a Medicare for all system, whatever we kind of call it. How would that also impact people in this field, and I think thereby impact access, right? Because if we have more doctors, we have more access as well.
Well, I would love to have just one set of rules, one formulary, one set of regulations. I don't mind having regulations. I don't mind having some rules that, you know, that are important to maintaining good care. That's obviously something that we all believe in. The problem right now is I have patients with different insurance. Each of them covers a different cholesterol drug, for example, or a different blood pressure drug. And sometimes if the patient changes insurance the next year, it's a different, I have to go through a prior authorization procedure that takes me 15 minutes to get permission for this patient to stay on this drug or to go to another drug. And if you imagine that some people, very, very sick people, again, a lot of the people I see are on, some of them are on 10 or 15 medications. They have very complicated illnesses. Imagine multiplying that out to have to deal with all those different insurances, different changes every single year, the copays, the deductibles, all those things are things that fall on primary care. It is a maddening day. And it gets in the way of me being able to properly take care of people. I find that I spend a lot of time, and mind you, we still have paper charts. We don't even have the electronic records that are maddening for most physicians at this point. I would love to be able to just take care of patients and have one payer, one set of rules. Everyone has the same coverage. Everyone operates in the same way. You know, automatically, one formulary would change this drastically. And a formulary basically is just sort of a menu of drugs that are covered by a particular payer. And again, there's hundreds of them. Imagine if we just had one. And we could save an enormous amount of money if Medicare were allowed to do what Walmart does. Give me the best price you can give me. You all, there's four in the same category. Give me the lowest price. We allow Walmart to do it, but we don't allow Medicare to do it. That would save tremendously on drug costs. Now, granted, that would have to be done at the national level. But in my world, it would be tremendous if I could just take care of patients and everyone I knew coming in the door had the same coverage. It would actually, I think most doctors who are retiring early would not do so. We love our patients. We love the relationships. We love delivering primary care. It's the other stuff that is causing burnout and early retirement.
And what is, like, just ballpark, and then I'll let David go. But like, when you look at your time, what percentage of your time do you spend with patients versus on paperwork and all the other?
I would say it's about one third. And mind you, that is actually better than my colleagues who have electronic records, who tell me for every hour they spend with a patient, they spend an hour doing administrative. I do far less because we have paper records and it's not as many little click, 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 click kind of things that, you know, that they have to do. It's actually easier. And so I would say, yes, it would significantly reduce that and make it so much easier in terms of just doing billing, et cetera. It would make all of that so much easier for all of us. And I think most of us would probably hang around a lot longer.
Dr. Deb, I'm extremely grateful for this conversation on multiple levels. And just to allow this to percolate a little bit more, you said we are potentially approaching a tipping point, and I think that's correct. I also think it's correct to say that as we begin to go down this road, locally, regionally, and nationally, we probably will be able to ease our way into a process that allows for people to remove this from the partisan lens or from a lens of argumentation toward that conversation and lens of this being a public good. Because really, and this is where I end with, what is a, you know this better than I do, what does a patient want for themselves or for their family? They just want to feel better. They just, that's all a patient wants, is for themselves or for their loved one to feel better, period.
And they want a relationship with a primary care clinician of some kind, whether a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, or primary care physician, at someone that they trust, that they know that the information that they're getting, that they share in a decision about their care and about the treatment, they want that as well. They want access to that. Most people don't want to spend time in an emergency room, don't want to end up in a cardiologist's office or an endocrinologist's office if they can get the same care or better care earlier with their primary care clinician. It's just, you know, and again, if we invest more money in that sector, we could see a lowering of costs. We've seen this around the world. And by the way, I just want to add also that when we talk about, Meg, you brought it up, I think it's important for people to realize we are paying every cent of the $6.2 billion that we're going to spend on healthcare in Vermont this year. And when people think that they get it at work, it's, they get lower wages. So one way or another, you're paying taxes, you're paying out of pocket, you're paying lower wages, you're paying higher prices for goods. But one way or another, we're paying every red cent of this healthcare dollar. It's not coming from insurance companies, it's coming from us. And that money is more than enough to pay for universal, comprehensive coverage for every single Vermonter, and again, across the country. This is the myth. And that to me is something we need to end with, that people need to understand it is possible and it is something that is inevitable. There is no other way to solve the problem.
Well, I think, and that's the perfect way to close this episode, to your point. There is an inevitability that this is, this public good is inevitable because it is, it's all we have. We have our health, we have our words, everything else in many ways is extraneous to our very existence. So this, there is an inevitability to this. I think you are right. And to the extent that this is framed and managed in a way that allows for people to rally around the public good as opposed to rally around the extraneous issues, maybe we get somewhere.
Right.
Well, Dr. Deb, thank you. Thank you very much. I know we will have more conversations. I'm very grateful. I'm grateful for your time, and I'm grateful for what
you do every day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was another extraordinary conversation, Meg. And I keep coming back to the central premise of this discussion, as we talked about in the opening, and certainly with Dr. Deb. Patients just want to get better. And people want to know healthcare is there for them when they need it. I strongly believe that both outcomes need to be addressed within the context of a public good. A public good, just so we're all clear, in the language of economics, is a product or a service that is considered non-excludable and non-depletable. So what does that really mean? A good or a service is non-excludable if you can't exclude any individual from enjoying its benefits. And a good is non-depletable if one individual's enjoyment or use of the good or service does not diminish the amount or quality of the good available to others. An example we talk about all the time is national defense. Because it's assumed that a state, a country, a nation state, cannot choose to protect just some of its residents from foreign aggression while excluding others from that protection. So too, providing one resident with national defense does not diminish the protection being provided to others. Healthcare needs to be defined similarly. We defend our nation robustly from external military threats and should similarly ensure that our nation's internal health is defended as aggressively. That's our very bold challenge.
And that is a bold challenge. And I think one of the outcomes of moving healthcare to a public good, as you're mentioning, David, as Dr. Deb was talking about, is that it allows us to create a streamlined system. A system that allows doctors to be doctors, and it allows their focus to be on their patients. And one of the things that Dr. Deb said that I was really, really struck me and I was shocked to hear was that up to 50% of a doctor's time is used on paperwork, coding, figuring out compliance for insurance companies. That just doesn't seem to make sense. And it's obvious that we have a long way to go, but you've identified our bold challenge. Healthcare is a public good. I think the general population agrees. And I think here in Vermont, we're on the road to making it happen.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening. We have a very special announcement about our next guest. Our next guest is a friend, a lifelong friend of mine, and a hero in the United States, Congressman Ted Lieu. What Ted does is known to so many of us here in Vermont and around the nation. He is an extraordinary advocate for what's right, for what needs to happen. He has a moral compass like no one I have ever known. And we will be talking with him about so many of the policies that affect us here, affect our entire nation, and in fact, affect us globally. The work that Ted is doing in the U.S. House of Representatives is remarkable. And I can't wait for that discussion. It'll be quite something.
I'm so excited about that conversation happening in 2 weeks, and I know our listeners don't want to miss it. So please subscribe to the show right now, wherever you're listening, or hit follow on Spotify so you'll hear the conversation with Congressman Liu, and you won't miss any opportunities to think boldly with us. And I do ask you, if you're an Apple user, if you're listening to us on iTunes, give us a rating. And if you have a comment, share it there so we can integrate your thoughts into this show.
And of course, if you have any questions or thoughts, you know we want to hear from you. Please, as always, send us an email at ideas@boldideaspod.com. Submit your questions or comments or thoughts. Thank you again. Remember to think bold. We look forward to next time.